So last time we have heard a few basics on attribute grammars and have seen a few examples in that, reformulating the Berisethi algorithm in a way that it conforms to kind of a standard in attribute grammars. And we have had some basic reflections on that, particularly on we asked ourselves whether the systems that we set up with these means are actually ones that can be computed with ordinary means without restricting the values of the attributes too much. And we came to the conclusion that although the general approach is quite expensive, there are a few ways out of that by either not caring at all and let the user run into its doom, his or her doom, or to somehow determine a subclass of attribute systems for which we can be sure that the automatic evaluation is always possible, or try to go around that in a dynamic way. So the idea that I want to show you first is one way to certify for a particular attribute grammar that this is indeed acyclic. And you might remember my last slide where I said that the actual test for the acyclic property would be quite expensive. So the idea would be not to certify that, but another property which is easier to prove on a particular grammar, at the cost of not being able for a few grammars that are actually cycle-free to actually be able to certify that they are cycle-free. And this is the idea of the strongly acyclic attribute dependencies. So in case that you can certify for a grammar that it is strongly acyclic, then it's still acyclic. It's just that a few grammars that are acyclic are not strongly acyclic. So it still suffices to show that you can create or generate an attribute evaluator for such a thing without running into circular dependencies. It's just that you can't apply this for every acyclic grammar. However, you get the benefit of the thing to be actually easily or somewhat easier to compute. So the trick to achieve that is not to try to be overly precise in the dependencies that you track. Instead, you decide to, at the level of each of the possible subtrees that there are, to join all the dependencies that are possibly created for all of the different subtrees that belong to one particular non-terminal. So you join all the productions that alternatives that belong to one non-terminal into one approximative dependency graph that is valid as an over approximation of all the different ones that would be valid for the different variants. And thus you create a certain kind of over approximation that can help you to get the computational explosion of having to fiddle with all the possible real dependencies. You can break that down into just having these over-approximated versions. Way to do so would be then to, for each of these non-terminals, to track such a set of over-approximating dependency sets. And that is a thing that we will see in the next few slides being constructed in a quite formal way, and I try to illustrate that with kind of graphical animations to get you an idea of what the different components of that formal approach is. And yeah, let's go into that. So the goal is to come up with some way of specifying how this over-approximation can be achieved. And this over-approximation is a thing that we access via this R of X, while where X is some non-terminal of your grammar. And if I say R of X, I mean this over-approximated set of dependencies for that particular non-terminal. And the way that this looks like is pretty similar to what the actual concrete dependency structure of that particular production might look like. But you join all the concrete dependencies from all the variants for a particular non-terminal together with the possible approximations of the children that come in there. So you do that in a divide and conquer fashion. You begin with just the basic non-terminals that don't depend on particularly much, apart from maybe the terminals, and then iteratively propagate the over approximations that you get by that into other productions and their non-terminal over approximations, and follow these propagations until the whole system stabilizes. How you do that in detail is via a chain of different tools that we need to introduce for that. So in general, what we do is that we work on dependency graphs as the type for the things we want to keep book of, in order to somehow deal with them and adapt one dependency into another. We need to somehow modify them a little bit. So there's a few tools to do that. For example, there is the redecoration operator here that takes a set of dependencies L and redecorates them such that the dependencies are interpreted as if they would occur at a certain child's index or even the root node's index of a particular subtree of this syntax tree. So how it does that is that it decorates each of the attribute names with the respective indices in there. What that does is that is what you see over there. So this is the set L that has some dependency graph in there, and if you apply a redecoration with that operator, you let it become a particular part of a larger structure that is given by this index I. So if you, for example, redecorate with index 2, this becomes the second child of a larger structure. Okay? So this is the first component that we need. The next thing is kind of a possible reverse operation to that, which would be the root projection. This is this pi 0 thing. And this would break down the dependencies that are given as parameter to that thing to only represent the dependencies that are found on the root node level. So if a graph looks like this in several levels, it's usually having relations that are decorated with the numbers that belong to the level and the children's index that they belong to. This root projection only considers the relations that deal with level 0. So what it does is it completely removes everything else. So this will just chop off everything from this graph that doesn't talk about the first line, like this. So this is what the root projection is. Next component is the thing that now assembles complete subtrees for particular productions. And this now makes use of things that we have already seen before. Particularly, there are parts that do redecoration. So this takes lists of dependencies that are given as parameter to this operator, puts them in particular places via this redecoration, joins them with the local dependencies introduced by the production that is also given as a parameter to this operator. Then it looks at the transitive closure of everything. So it, when there is chains of dependencies between them, you get the shortcut out of that and do that until the whole thing stables. So what that does is, first you get those partial relation collections, then you put them into connect them together based on what the production actually says and what position of parameter they have. So you get kind of combined graph out of that. And then you do transitive closure followed by a root projection, which means that if there's a path from one root attribute to another root attribute, you compress that into one arrow and forget about the way how you achieve this compression, like this. Okay? So with that, you now have a tool that, given a particular production, can subsume the dependency that is induced by whatever is occurring as the child dependencies. And with that now, you assemble a thing that gives you this over-approximation that we were talking about. Because what you do is you now take all the productions that concern a particular non-terminal X and join the outcome of the operator that we have seen before, which did this assembly of whatever comes as parameter, we will see later on, into the according subtree structure and extracts the dependencies that are created by that. The crucial part now here is, where do these parameters come from that we plug into the children's places? Well, those are themselves also over approximations for whatever dependencies are over approximated so far for the non-terminals that belong to these right-hand sides of productions. So these x1 to xk can be taken from here. So, or are taken from here. So this is the connection, and for each of those we assume that we have so far at least a partial understanding of how to over-approximate them. So this is what we use as a starting ground for creating our current idea of how the dependency set for X is over-approximated. With that, we get a new understanding of how dependencies for X are over-approximated, which will help us by in finding out about other non-terminals over approximations by plugging this newly created dependency set into the respective structures of other non-terminals. So this is, in that sense, a declarative specification of what we actually want to compute. And turns out that that is a system for which we can find unique least solutions, so solutions that introduce a minimal number of dependencies between the attributes of each non-terminal, while still complying to the requirements of the local dependencies of each non-terminal's production, as well as the possible inlinings of each of the non-terminal's over-approximations into others. So this is, you might wonder, what does such a declarative specification actually give us? Well, it turns out that such things can be computed quite nicely via a fixed point iteration, where you start from no dependencies at all and start adding whatever dependency is induced by just the local dependencies in order to get larger characterizations of dependencies for each thing, and you start propagating these updates into other equations that then themselves produce larger of approximations, which can then be again put into another equation, and so on, until the system at one point stabilizes with the least solution of the characterization that we have found here. So, in that sense, what you do is you start with setting all the over approximations of the non-terminals to, well, empty set for a start, and then you go through all the equations for all the non-terminals and start evaluating that thing. And in case that you encounter that you get something out of that which is larger than the empty set, which can be quickly found whenever there is some kind of dependency in there, then you will put this new value into other right-hand sides of these equations, and so on. And you do so until there is no change in the sets that you have computed so far. So that's basic fixed point iteration. Okay. So I have prepared an example for that, but before we go into that, I would like to make sure that there's no unclarity left so far for these things here. So for all the operations that are, there are, you have somehow an intuition of what they do?
Well, I have a confession that in case of production, where the right-hand side contains a non-terminal that is on the left-hand side, so more or less a recursion,
yes,
would be then used for the first set, just empty set,
as yes. Yeah. So that is why I have this line down there. This is kind of the lower bound for every over-approximating set of dependencies. This is just, there's no dependency so far known. And just applying these right-hand sides to each of these parameter sets just creates always larger values. So this will, if you put it in again, the worst thing that could, or best thing depending on your view, is you can just get another larger value, and thus you can just plug it in there until it stabilizes. So you approximate your desired solution from the bottom. So apart from that, I think you have to just bear in mind there's this redecoration to put the relations in place. There is transitive hull, which you already know. Then there is root projection, which cuts away everything from there. And then everything else that happens is just finding the right spots where to plug each thing in and joining everything. So, well, that is a thing that I have missed, of course. The thing is now, how do we know whether a thing is now acyclic or not? Well, you have to look at all the these clauses of your local dependency structure for particular production, with all its over approximations of children's relations put into, and if these things are acyclic for all possible productions, then you have made sure that in your whole attribute grammar you cannot have any cycles. Okay, so let's have an example. This is a very small attribute grammar, otherwise these things escalate quite quickly. So as principle, these are things that you would want to code and not to do by hand, but in order to understand them we have to do them by hand. So the grammar looks like S goes to L, L goes to A or B, and the local dependency graphs look the following way. So it's just graphs for subtree types. So what you then do is you pick whatever non-terminal you like and start with that. I do that in a kind of semi-intelligent fashion so that we don't have to endure a lot of slides, but in principle it doesn't play any particular role. The fixed point iteration will make sure that you at some point will reach your result in the end anyway. So I pick this this L non-terminal, which is realized with two productions. So there's the production L goes to A and L goes to B. So what we need to do is we need for each of them we need to do this assembly of the local dependencies together with the over approximated dependencies from the children. For the children there is nothing there because it's just terminals. We own for terminals there is no actual dependencies that are introduced in our world at least. So there, what we get from that is just the local dependency graphs. They look like this and like this. Okay, we don't have to do any redecoration for that because there is no thing to plug in. So lucky us here. Then we can do the transitive closure of all the relations that we get out of that, and there is no actual chains of dependencies in there, so this is easy. As a side note, we can already start trying to check for cycles at that level, because as soon as we hit we will have ascending chains of relation set, and as soon as we find the first cycle, we will never reach a point where the cycle disappears again. So we can check for these cycles always when we do that step, and we never have to return to each of them separately. So we do the check, but the check says there's nothing done here. So what we can do now is we can do root projection, remove all the unnecessary junk from the level below, just keeping these things, and then what happens here is we then join the so far collected dependencies into one thing that we store as the over approximated dependencies for L, which will give us that thing here. Yes?
The operator is the union and afterwards
transitive global. Yes. So this the square thing is just my abbreviation for, I think I had it explicitly here, so it's union plus this thing in that case. I didn't put it on the slides, but good for you to ask, actually. Quickly spotted. I maybe should have done that explicitly. So, yeah, you join them into one and get that. So, with that, nothing found so far. We go over to the next thing. This is the over-approximation for non-terminal S, and this is the production that we have for that. So we take that into our local production assembly operator, and this has a non-terminal on the right-hand side. So for that, we plug the over-approximation for the non-terminal L in there, which will then be used in the actual definition of that thing at the place of the first parameter. So this whatever we have what we have gotten for this L, which is this over approximation here, will be taken and plugged into index one, which is here. So all the relations from here will go into their respective places in the local dependency graph. So redecorate and embed leads to this thing here, and then we usually then do the closure of all relations as well as a check for cycles. And well, in terms of closure, I could now start drawing a lot of arrows here, from here to there, for example, from here to there, and from here to even there, which already is a strong indication for, well, there's a cycle. But anyway, so this is a thing that I haven't done on the slide itself, because it's pretty messy to have all this the transitive closures. Anyway, what we don't get any edge for is an edge that goes from one root attribute to another. So there is no dependency added to the root nodes by the children in that example here, just as a kind of side remark. Anyway, transitive closure and the projection would still give us that there is no dependency between H and J induced by the dependencies so far uncovered for the children. And thus the dependencies for S remain nothing. So, but in between we had this check for cycles, and it turned out, well, there actually is a cycle in this thing here, and this means that this particular attribute grammar is not strongly acyclic. Now, what I have told you in the beginning is that this strong acyclicity is a thing that gives us only partially reliable information, in the sense that if it says something is acyclic, strongly acyclic, then it is also acyclic. However, if it says no, this thing is not strongly acyclic, it doesn't mean that the underlying attribute grammar is indeed also acyclic. And for that particular example, this can be seen, because for the grammar that I've given you, there's only two actual concrete parse trees, so you can have a look at those and actually do the check whether those things are cyclic. And these are the two graphs that you can get out of that. So this one, and you see, well, yeah, this is not cyclic, because you would need this edge in order to make it cyclic. Then there's the other one, and for that you would need the other edge in order to make it cyclic. So these are the only two possibilities that there are, and neither of them carries a cycle. So indeed, this grammar would be acyclic. However, it was a grammar of a fashion for which we could not really show that it is acyclic with our over approximations. So here, this didn't lead to a satisfying result. This might now look particularly weak with respect to what attribute grammars can actually do. But don't let this misguide you. The way that we use attribute grammars will turn out to be, well, full attribute grammars are probably quite a lot to ask for and quite strong all in all. And if you look at the possible dependencies in there, there's quite a wild exchange of information going on here. So there's information that is backpropagated from here to there and from here to there. And then there's these other things that actually exactly close the gaps between the dependencies that we have introduced in this middle part. So this is already quite an artificial example in that sense, which was hand tailored to really close gaps for such a cycle. In the uses that we will see, we will usually have or we will use that in the context of programming languages, where there's often some kind of concept of, that we have instructions that are in some kind of sequence, which already implies a particular reading direction, which often corresponds to the actual transfer of information in such things. And if you have such a sequence somewhat implied by your syntax trees, then this already means that a lot of the information flow in such graphs usually goes roughly from the left to the right also. So this means that quite a lot of the information flow will usually go somewhat in a similar direction, so that these cycles and even the strong cycles are not so particularly common, at least for the examples that we look at. But of course, these attribute grammars in general are quite strong, and turns out that the come up with computation schemes for that, is quite a challenge because they are so expressive in that sense. Okay, so, but in general, what you've seen here is there is a test that you can use. If it certifies you that there is no cycle in there, then there's actually no cycle in the concrete thing. It just does a few mistakes on the side of saying, well, there is actually a circle. However, we have, it still is a thing that is at least somewhat efficient to compute compared to the precise thing. So this already gives us a lot to work with. And there's even ways to turn the intermediate results, which is these over-approximated set of dependencies, into a blueprint of how to implement an actual attribute system, evaluation system. So you can somehow generate the attribute evaluators out of the dependencies that you have computed that way, and thus generate such an automated evaluation system somewhat efficiently. So it has its uses. However, at that point, I wanted to stop from diving more into that and show a little bit more of what the world does with these systems. So to now come to evaluation strategies, there's several ideas of how to achieve that. course, you can always let the user do whatever he wants. The other thing is the idea of automated strategies based on dependencies. One way I have somehow sketched you now a little bit cloudy, but there's also concrete ones that you can look at. And the other idea is to fix the strategy and only use the attribute systems that are actually computable with these strategies. And we will see an example of that a little bit later on. So for automatic strategies, what is out there? Well, you could do, for example, demand-driven evaluation when you have first made sure that the dependencies are acyclic. You can just use the dependencies to guide you to the attributes and their equations, to evaluate them, and you can be sure that there is no actual circle of dependencies involved. So this on-demand evaluation will terminate at some point. So what you do is you start the evaluation of the attribute that you actually require, and then follow the dependencies to the attributes that you need for computing the thing, while suspending the computation until you have all the results for the attributes, and then recursively evaluate those attributes. The other thing would be to organize your computation in concept of passes. So you sweep over your tree structure repeatedly during a particular pass on this tree. You evaluate all the attributes for which all the you evaluate all the attributes equations for which all the parameters are already available, and repeat to do that until the whole attribute system is at one point completely evaluated. So it depends solely on your requirements, whether you are interested at just local information only, or whether you will know that at some point you will gonna be accessing all the attributes anyway. So for one situation, demand-driven is better. For the other situation, evaluation passes is better. The evaluation passes emanates from the concept that that operate or computing the attribute equations locally for each of the nodes is a lot more efficient than following the dependencies for each of the demand-driven evaluations. But, well, you might wonder whether this kind of locality is really a thing that gives you the speed that you're after, considering how the tree structure is spread in main memory anyway. So, you might wonder. Also, you can kind of bring the demand-driven evaluation in areas which are quite close to the evaluation passes if you kind of just cache the values that you have computed during the demand-driven evaluation anyway. So with that, you can memorize your algorithm and just reuse the values that you have created during earlier demand-driven evaluations. So as an example for demand-driven evaluation, you could, for example, be interested just in the next attributes of the leaves A2, A3 and B4, for example. So for those, well, the next for A3 and A4, both of them rely on the attribute of next from same parent. So you just, for example, start with A3's next computation and access the parents thing, and therefore you need to access the parents value, and then at the old thing, you will then just have to rely on things that are not given in the next thing itself, but instead are already present by the evaluation of the attributes. Oh, well, no, sorry, this was the wrong path. So this is just next zero here, because we come from the second child, so this is just next zero, and there it terminates. Next, for the root node, is just always the empty set. So this is the first line of attributes that has been evaluated. Then for before, you can just reuse the values that you have computed in the query before. So if you cache them, you can just directly compute the attribute for before. And well, now it's only a question of how to do the A2 things. And here we run into the complicated clause where you need to start evaluating the attributes for first and empty. So this n depends on empty and first, and they themselves then are synthesized from the respective values of the children. So yeah, this spawns a whole lot of other evaluations that are then cached at their respective locations and in the end contribute to the evaluation of them. So the more queries for particular attributes you put into the system, the more you uncover all the attributes that are occurring in such a tree. So that is demand-driven evaluation. I think that is the next part would then be to somehow put it into code. So what can we summarize for that? In order to perform that kind of evaluation, one thing that you need is, well, for the synthesized attributes like this next, you somehow have to access the value of attributes from your root nodes. So you need some way of really accessing them, and the only way to do so is to somehow navigate to parents. So your representation must contain a pointer to the parent. This is a thing that might not have been there in your earlier implementations of trees. If you want to do such a demand-driven evaluation, you need to have such a thing. So this might be a drawback of that kind of thing. The other thing that you get is, well, it's only the required attributes that are evaluated. If you want to evaluate everything, you will have to put out queries for each and every attribute out there, which might be a little bit tedious. So also what you need to do is you need to track what has already been evaluated, keep your intermediate results in the form of values for other attributes around, and you might have to, if you don't do that, you might visit nodes more often than necessary. Also, we have seen that this algorithm is not a low-click thing. So what to take away from that is that the evaluation strategy is a dynamic one. Thus, when you want to start debugging such a thing, you might run into, or you might have large question marks in your head when you just interrupt somewhere in the middle and ask yourselves, what am I actually really doing here? So debugging is not so easy in that thing. And also, for most of the cases that you'll see, actually all the attributes in the nodes will at some point be required. So you might wonder whether just a computation of all the attributes in one go is maybe a cheaper solution to that. So let's have a look at how to do something like that in task-organized things. And since we're talking about passes on such trees anyway, we might as well talk about a particular often recurring problem, particularly the problem of somehow managing the concept of a state throughout all the equations that that specify how the attributes are evaluated. And an example would be if you would like to for example realize the thing like just counting and labeling all the leaves that you find in a particular tree. So this is a thing that doesn't come obvious in such a system. You need some kind of state during the evaluation of your attributes that tells you about the number of leaves that you have already counted and labeled. And you need to somehow communicate that you have visited a new one at that moment. So how can you do such a thing with attribute grammars? There's a recurring pattern of how to do that, which would be to introduce a particular set of helper structures in there, which would be attributes that for now we will call pre and post, and they are already named because they are somehow linked to particular events during a pass through the tree, particularly to the pre-visit events and the post-visit events. So what we use them for would be that within the pre-attribute we will pass our state encoded into a value of that attribute down in the in the tree, whereas in the post attribute we will collect up the state that we have transported down there at some point and repropagate it back to the top of the tree in form of a synthesized attribute. So for doing something like numbering of leaves, what we could do is we could, for all the root, or for just the root element, we would introduce the initialization of the state. It's the initial state at the start of the pass through the tree with value 0, meaning that we have encountered 0 leaves so far. And then we would propagate the state along the pass through the tree by saying that pre1, so the child's value of the pre-attribute corresponds to the value of the root, and you also collect the results if post 0 is post 1. So this just, depending on how many children you actually have, you'd have to replace this one thing with the last children's. So in nodes, if we have just binary trees, we have just two children. So what we do there is we take the pre-value from our root, communicate it to the pre-value of the left child. We take the post-value of the left child and take it as the pre-value of the right child and set the post-value of this particular subtree to the post-value of the right child. And the leaves are the ones where we have decided to do some actual work. So the post of the leaf would be the pre of the leaf plus 1, in the sense that we modify the state because we have encountered another leaf, and with that we would have to manipulate the state. So that sense, what we do in this kind of pattern is we always transport down along tree structures. When we meet leaves, we will move the downwards directed data element and put it back into the upper direction. And if we have siblings, we transport the state value from one sibling to the other until in the end, when we have reached the last sibling, we will communicate the value back to the parent. So this, in that sense, moves a state along the tree following the depth first search run on this tree. So this is a quite useful structure that has a particular name. This is this way of, well, maybe not particularly this. Let's maybe forget about that for a moment. First of all, let's concentrate on what we have here as a statement. So, with the things that you see here, you only have communication that goes down the yellow path. At the leaves, you have communication from yellow to red. In the intermediate things, you have from red to yellow and from red to red. With such a thing, you will, if you do it in this manner, you will not be able to create any cycles in that sense. So this is a thing which is even provable strongly, basically. This is even showing another property that we have a special name for, which is called L attributation, which means that in a system of attribute grammar, we only have a particular way that the dependencies are occurring. Particularly for a production, it looks like S goes to S1 to Sn. Every inherited attribute of Sj only depends on either the inherited attributes of S itself or the attributes from S1 to Sj minus 1, which would be the previous siblings in that sense. So this is called L attributation because L is a particular L has a particular long form, but this kind of corresponds to the direction in which the dependencies can occur in the inherited attributes. So you can depend from the root nodes and the siblings to the left mainly. So this is what L attributation is. And L attributation has the nice property that it can be evaluated, for example, during parsing directly. So while you perform your parsing run through the thing, you will work on your syntax trees from the left to the right, and usually from the top. And in an LL parser generator, for example, you will be able to construct all the necessary propagations directly while doing parsing. So this was quite a nice property for LL parsers. L attribute grammars in general have a particular nice evaluation structure, strategy that is just this that first search traversal through the whole tree. And in order to implement that, you would partition your attributes of your attribute system so that you can put as many attributes as possible into part of this partition and evaluate them with one the first traversal on your tree, and then restart your depth first traversal for the next part of your attributes. And usually you try to maximize it in a way that you can evaluate as much as possible for each run. And in our example with the Perisethi, for example, you could join the first and empty computation into one depth first traversal, whereas for the next attribute you would have to restart at that first traversal to evaluate that thing. So this would be an example for a partition that you can create for evaluation. So what you then usually do in the field of semantic analysis is that you design your attribute system in a way that is compatible to this L attributation system, so that it can be partitioned into as few as possible different L attributed sets, and thus would be quite efficient to be evaluated. Particularly since this construction of state implementation in the fashion of pre and post attributes is possible, and this is compatible to L attributation, you already have quite a powerful tool to your disposal. So, practical applications of that are quite famous tasks in programming languages. So, for example, doing declaration use analysis and type checking and inference, or even code generation, are analysis or runs on the attributes that can all be specified with L-attributed grammars. So if you set up systems for those purposes, you can just apply your usual the first runs on your tree structure and have the attributes evaluated on the first go, and don't have to worry too much about complexity of these kinds of things. So how you do that is usually you annotate the syntax trees with additional information, and you do that depending on the actual identity of the left-hand side symbol, so the non-terminal that spawns the subtree there. And for each of these things, you will introduce a particular type that carries certain attributes that you are interested in. And the way that you then encode your attribute equation system can be, for example, done with particular system that I want to show you, which is this visitor pattern that you can use in order to realize attribute systems for L-attributation. So you could you would have your type for a node in your syntax tree as a kind of abstract base type, like for example for regular expressions you would have class like this regex thing, and you would implement the concrete non-terminals as special classes of these things, like the OR expression being a special regular expression that has two children, left and right. And what you would add to these systems would be an interface that connects these types of things to a so-called visitor. So you have these accept methods that generalize the depth-first search on your tree by hard-coding this depth-first search in there, in the way that they say, well, you will do first an accept on the left child, and then later on you will do an accept on the right child. So this, the chain of accept calls that you find in such a system would correspond to a depth first run. And all you now need to do is you need to trigger the callbacks for the events that happen during such a search by, for example, triggering, well, maybe another color, triggering the pre-visit event before you descend into the children of the Orex by triggering the visitor's pre-method on this particular thing. And after you leave the visitation of that subtree, you would trigger the post event with this v.post thing. And in order to catch also the situations where you are in between two visitations of your children, you might also introduce something like this inter-call thing. So all you now need to do is to provide the callback methods for all the different events, and you do that in form of a general visitor that features all these pre and post things. And in case you're interested in acting on a particular event, you just override the particular method that you're interested in. And in such a way, you can, for example, implement something like leave numbering in visitor, where you do just you keep the state that you're managing in, for example, the hash table here, but you could also just add attributes to the elements of the tree. So in that sense, add fields to the regex class, for example, or to the complete classes, depending on what you're actually really wanting to, what you actually want to achieve. So for our case, we're not so really interested in the actual real multitude of attributes. We just wanted to do the enumeration of leaves, and for that we just keep a hash map with that maps the regular expressions to the actual integers. We initialize the root node with zero, and then just communicate throughout the pre visits the parents' value to the children. At the post visits, the children's value back to the parent, and in between the left child's value to the right child's value. And only when we are when we encounter the event of visiting leave, what we actually do is we increment the number that we find at the parents node, and put the incremented number into the leaves node, which will then be taken back to the innards of the tree by the post visit later on. So, yeah, that is that in a sense. So, with such a system or a similar one, you can pretty quickly develop your visitor for a particular attribute system and analyze that in a pass on the tree via a call to accept with that visitor. So I think there should be probably a few tutorial exercises on that in the tutorial. So let's dive into the actual applications for the attribute systems. So we now leave the general area of attribute systems and look into what we actually really need for doing semantic analysis in programming languages. So the first thing that comes to mind for that is the so-called declaration use analysis. And this is the problem of, well, code having having users of particular names, like here, here, or here, or here, And the general question of, well, if I use a particular name here, names can be everything, you just have the generic pattern of an identifier. Is this a thing that we have actually properly introduced to the system in order to define the memory requirements of such a thing? And what are the what is, for example, the location of the memory where this particular value has to be kept during runtime? So for that, you usually would like to have some kind of relation of the use of a particular variable to its declaration. So in that sense, this would be a relation from this identifier to this one. This one would have to also go to this one. Whereas, for example, the identifier down there, although it the latest declaration that it has seen is this one directly over there, this has to be related to this one, same as this one here. So there are certain relations between uses and declarations, and it's important to find the right declarations for the right use. And as soon as you introduce this relation between a use and a declaration, you will have a binding of that particular identifier to its declaration. And this is not a trivial thing, since we have seen here it's not so that the last declaration that I have seen is the one that I have to take, but you have to take into account that there is a concept of visibility of certain declaration, and that has to do with things like a scope that you can introduce. So there's certain boundaries that are there for the scope of the variable. So for example, the first declaration here is within the scope that spans over this more or less whole body, whereas the declaration in there has a scope that is not as large. This ends a little bit earlier. And the thing is that both of these scopes somehow overlap in terms of regions that are spanned by these scopes. So the regulation here is that scopes that are children of other scopes can overshadow definitions from their parents' scopes. And this is a thing that has to be taken into account in declaration use analysis. So the question is, how can I do my management of identifiers such that I follow these kind of complicated systems? So, yeah, maybe this is a thing that we have already talked about, that we must translate it this somehow to memory access later on. That's why we actually need the connection with the declaration. And the thing is that whenever we do the actual translation later on, we don't want to manually fiddle around until we at some point navigate through our tree and find the concrete declaration, but we want to have some kind of easy and convenient way of accessing this declaration. So there's certain elements to that. For example, we usually will not really deal with complicated strings like we do on the source level, but we would rather like to have some kind of unique identifiers for that. So usually we will at some point relate string names with integer values and use them as keys for looking up things, since comparisons in integers are a lot quicker. Also, what we would usually want to have is some kind of direct link or pointer to from the usage of a variable to its declaration, in order to directly access whatever type this is, what the size of this thing is, and where Whenever we decide where to put that in memory, we might then use this pointer to obtain this location specification from the declaration. So how to realize that? Well, for rapid access, we will somehow have to replace the strings with integers, and this might be a thing that you already know if you have had the introduction by Helmut. I don't know how much you have done in, about hashing otherwise. So hashing would be the key thing. This is a mapping from strings to integers, and how you would do that is you would have some facility like this index for identifier where you can retrieve unique IDs for strings in case that they are semantically the same. And what you would do about that is you would look the string up in the hash table in case it is it yields undefined. What you would do is you would extend the hash table by a new mapping from the string to a particular variable count, which is a general counter for strings, which is then immediately incremented. And well, you can also use this thing to just look up indices for already known identifiers. So what you will do then is you just return the content of that thing. So in order to do that, you need to somehow associate strings with integers, and that's where the hash function comes into play. So you need some kind of function that maps your string to an integer of sufficiently small size in order to serve as an index in an array. And what you also would like is that this hash table is somewhat cheap to compute in order to not replace a complicated string handling thing with a complicated hash function. You want to actually not do too much string computation here. So the other thing is it needs to somewhat equally distribute the occurring strings over the set of available values such that I don't create a bad structure in the store for all these strings in the array. But we'll see how that relates a little bit later on. So maybe some candidates for hash tables. So there's kind of a very simple one, which is easy to or cheap to compute, which will just take the first and the last character of the string, add them, and then take the modulo versus a particular prime number, and this would be your hash value, for example. This might be sufficient enough, depending on how identifiers actually look like. You can even enrich that a little bit by adding other points of interest from these strings, like the middle character or whatever, and take that into the sum over here. If you would want to have, well, a very precise version of that, you would just, somehow take all the characters of your string into account with such a thing. And this is a common expression of how that encodes a sequence of finite characters into a single unbounded integer. So this is kind of a standard technique of encoding strings in that sense. So what you do is you choose a sufficiently large a prime number that is, usually as large as the number of characters that you can, the number of different characters that you can have in your strings, and use these factors as kind of a positional positional expression. So for each position in the string, this would just shift the actual character as much to the left as the index number gives you by multiplying that with the this positional expression. And in that sense, you would have kind of a string representation in your numbers structure. And yeah, well, by summing up these things, you can directly have a unique number for each of the possible strings that there are. And yeah, if you then just take a modulo of that, this is pretty. Taking pretty much everything that the string has to offer into this encoding. But, well, as it touches all the possible characters of a string, this is pretty expensive also in that sense. Anyway, what you get out of that is, of course, the remainder of a division, which might be a thing that maps every not every string to a different number, so this might not be a unique thing. So what you then would do, you would just not keep singular strings at each of the array's contents, but instead you would have lists, and if you want to search for a particular hash table entry, you will then have to piece by piece have to compare all the entries that you have stored in the list at a particular hash values index. So, anyway, that is the components that you need to implement a hash table for strings. Thus, that you can start associating your identifiers with numbers instead of actual strings anymore. So if you have an input of the identifiers like this here, you will get an output that is just the identifiers of these strings. So each time that you reuse a particular thing, like the Peter here, so this Peter occurs here and here, so you will have the same identifier reappearing in here. This Piper thing also is reflected in here. So that is the usual output there. So same names are actually mapped to same indices with that thing. And this structure underneath would look like that. Your hash table with the values like MS7 and the first variant of a hash function would have a table like this, where there's actual collisions in your hash function. Anyway, so much just for interpreting the strings that belong to identifiers as numbers. This is a thing that you would usually already do at the scanner level. And instead, the only thing that remains to do in the semantic analysis would be to actually create the references from uses to declarations and emanate from the precondition that the strings have already associated a unique ID with them. So for referring to the correct declarations, what you do is you traverse the syntax tree in a suitable sequence such that the declarations are actually listed before the uses. You keep track of the declarations that are currently visible. And yeah, this is usually the last one that has been visited up to a certain degree. And that is a thing. If your declaration is meant to be occurring before the use, this is already quite useful for this L attributation grammar thing, because this is reflected in this L dependency pattern that that we like to have. So an L attribute to Grammar would be nice for this purpose. And what you have to manage is that for each basic block, which is usually the place that opens and closes scope, you would have to add and remove declarations from your list of currently, or from your understanding of currently visible declarations, such that it corresponds to what the program actually really means. So in order to do so, what we usually do is that for each of the identifiers, we manage a stack of declarations, since the scopes are things that are opened at some point and then closed again, such that, that the underlying former state of declarations is visible again. So we need to temporarily change a thing, which we then have to undo. So this is usually what a stack is really quite well suited for. So whenever we visit a declaration, we might just then push a new declaration onto the stack for that particular identifier. And whenever we leave the scope, we have to remove that declaration again from the stack. And when we have such a structure, we can, during the run or during the pass through our program, whenever we find a usage of a particular identifier, we can just then access our data structure, access the stack of declarations for that particular identifier, and look up whatever the top declaration of this particular stack says, and this would be the declaration which we have to point that usage to. So that's that. The only situation that then can be is that when we have a usage of a variable and we realize, well, there isn't any data registered for that particular identifier yet, well, this would be an issue of an undeclared identifier being found, and this would usually be an error message that the compiler has to emit. So, in an example, how would that look like? Well, we would have for example, code like the one that you see down there. We would have the scanner give us identifiers for representing each of these actual identifiers. And yeah, we have several declarations in there. This declaration A, which we call, in order to not having complicated pointers or addresses around, just call this location B, this location W, this location X, this location Y, and that location Z. Unconveniently, I've run out of colors, but there's no other declaration left anymore. So, nice. Good. Now, the declaration use analysis, what that would do is it would run through the syntax tree representation of that thing, and as soon as we hit a declaration like the one in line 3, we would start putting or pushing content on the pushed on the stacks for the identifiers A and B. So for A, we would push V, while as for B, we would push W, for example, in the beginning. We see that. And while we then continue through the program, for example, at line 4, we find a usage of an identifier, like this B over here. So what we do is we look at B, finding B associated with W. So we point the usage of B to the declaration W. Okay, then we continue. Here, this if thing again has a usage. It's B again. There's nothing changed in this thing yet, so B still be referred to this thing. Then we will hit another declaration in another scope. So there is the declaration of A, which will lead to, since this is location X, lead to a new location pushed onto the data structure for A, which is formerly V, but now containing X. So A now points to X, while we also push a new declaration for Z, which is called Y. So for C, we didn't have anything before, so we keep this the first element of the stack here. Here, the stack contains X now, and V is somewhere at the bottom of the stack. So now we continue through the program, finding the use of A here, which will be resolved into whatever is the topmost element of the stack. So this is X, so this will be mapped to X. And we have another A being mapped to X. C is mapped to Y, so this goes to this one here. C again goes to Y, and B goes to the old W. Like this. Then we have the closing of a basic block, which will lead to the latest changes on the stacks to be removed. So this thing goes away, and this thing goes away, leading to V being a valid thing now, and also we reach a new declaration for C, with referring to the location Z. So Z goes to the stack for C. Now we continue. C now will be related to Z, so this goes here. A is related to V, so this goes here. C goes to Z, and B goes to W. Okay, and then if we continue, there's another closing basic block. So Z will be removed for the final state, where this Z is popped away, and then we can also only resolve B to W anymore. A goes to V, and W again to B again to W. So this looks nice. The only question is, from where do I know that I have to remove Y and X when I leave this basic block? And well, there's several techniques that you could do. Well, this is not about the techniques. This is now about the actual links in the underlying syntax tree and its attributes. Yeah, well, that is what we have painted in our program by hand. What we can do is we can introduce markers onto each of the stacks. For example, here we have a different color, but we could also just have arbitrary elements, like another cell being pushed on there that says, well, this is a basic block delimiter. Everything that is above this delimiter will be popped at the next closing basic block, and everything underneath is safe for now. So this could be an idea. The far more common solution is to, instead of lists of symbols, what we usually do is we use lists of hash tables that where the topmost hash table is the one where all the new entries go into, and whenever we look up, we start in the list at the top, look at the freshest declarations, whether our use is found in there. If not, then we go one element deeper, look into that that thing, and continue until we reach the bottom. And if we have not found the use, a declaration for our use throughout this whole thing, then we have found an undeclared thing. Otherwise, we would just take the latest declaration that is in there, and as soon as we hit a closing basic block, we just remove the topmost hash table and just continue with everything that came beneath. So that would be a typical implementation of this problem. It gets a little bit nicer even if you have the luxury of being able to use persistent pre-structures or data structures. So those would usually return a new data structure on update of such a structure, with the benefit of internally reusing as much as possible from the former data structure. So this is a thing that doesn't usually take too much time to construct and too much space compared to a deep copy of the whole data structure, but still can be used as a new instance in case of an update. And with such a thing, you can just propagate your current symbol table down into the treatment of a particular block, have your declarations added to that thing as soon as you hit them, and whenever you leave that block, you just continue with the pointer to your current symbol table and ignore every update that has happened so far, and save yourself from having to perform any cleanup of your last block. So that is what you would usually do. So before we now continue with the next topic, I think we have reached an end for today, and with that, I want to thank you for your attention and have a nice week until next week. Thank you.